Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, July 21st. Did you hear who's throwing out the ceremonial first pitch at the first Major League Baseball game of the year this Thursday night? It's Yankees versus Washington Nationals right there in D.C. For those of you who don't know the term, throwing out the first pitch is a ceremonial thing before a big game starts that's supposed to represent something, supposed to have some meaning. Sometimes it's an old-time beloved player from the team that's hosting the game or things like that. But sometimes it's much more serious. Like after 9/11, President Bush, who was, of course, the sitting president, threw out the first pitch at the first World Series game after 9/11 that fall at Yankee Stadium, things like that. And so in this national crisis, the pandemic, it being such a big symbolic deal to our national recovery, Major League Baseball, the national pastime, is going to try to start a season with all these pandemic protocols. Did you know they're going to get tested? They are getting tested every other day, every player. And you might think this big first game right there in Washington, D.C., it might be the president again as a symbol of national unity against the virus, like it was the president after 9/11 as a symbol of national unity against Al-Qaeda. But even the jocks in professional sports know better than that. And the Washington Nationals chose instead Dr. Anthony Fauci. Maybe you heard. That just broke late yesterday. That'll be Thursday night at 7 on ESPN. As it happens, when Dr. Fauci was on this show last month, I asked him what kind of mask he wears, and we had this brief exchange.
Right now, I have a variety of cloth masks. My high school, Regis High School, that you mentioned, made one that said Regis for me on it. I have one that says the Washington Nationals on it, and I got a plain old black one that's got nothing on it.
So a Brooklyn Dodger fan transfers his loyalties eventually to the Washington Nationals.
Yeah, I'm really sorry I had to do that, but they are a great team.
Dr. Fauci, originally from Brooklyn, here last month. So there you go. Our symbol of national unity against the virus will not be the President of the United States, but the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Who even knew that title 6 months ago? The polls suggest that if Dr. Fauci was running for president, which he is not, he would beat President Trump hands down based on their relative approval ratings. But would Trump accept the results of that election? Will he accept the results if Joe Biden wins? With me now, Fareed Zakaria, usually the host of Fareed Zakaria GPS, his international affairs program, Sunday mornings on CNN, 10 a.m. Eastern. Last night, he hosted a CNN special called Donald Trump's Conspiracy Theories. He is also the author of books, including The Post-American World, which has been translated into 30 languages now, The Future of Freedom, a Liberal Democracy at Home and Abroad, and In Defense of a Liberal Education. Hi, Fareed. Thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Always a pleasure, Brian.
First of all, I don't know if you're a baseball fan, but usually the only thing that Democrats and Republicans in D.C. can agree on is that they are Washington Nationals fans. Now the Nationals have tapped Dr. Fauci to throw out the first pitch. Do you see it as partisan or symbolic in any way?
Well, I actually hope it's the opposite. I think that there used to be so many things in America that were not partisan. You know, life should not be partisan. It should be possible to have a normal, day-to-day life that kind of goes beyond politics. In a sense, it privileges politics too much to make everything partisan. And I think, in a sense, the Nationals were saying that Fauci is beyond partisanship. The guy served, you know, 8 presidents. So I hope it's an attempt to do the opposite. Now, some people might regard it as a political or partisan issue, but I think that gets to part of our problem. You know, we're the only country in the world where fighting COVID has become a partisan issue.
Today, it's being reported, President Trump will return to something he had given up doing, daily televised coronavirus briefings. Remember, he stopped doing them after they were politically backfiring on him, after he did things like wonder out loud if people should inject bleach into their bodies to clean the virus off their lungs like it cleans the virus off your sink. Obviously a dangerous suggestion. Don't try this at home, kids. And after many things like that, he stopped doing the briefings. Now he's starting them up again. As a political analyst, what do you make of it?
I have come to the conclusion that trying to analyze the effect of Donald Trump on his base is very, very difficult. So things that I would have thought would have been surefire losers, you know, denouncing John McCain and saying he wasn't a real war hero, or the Access Hollywood tapes and things like that. You know, there is a sense in which he is able to galvanize his base, partly because of the hostility that he invokes. You know, so the fact that people criticize him in just the way you just did about the bleach comment clearly has this effect of rallying his base, which feels threatened and defensive. So it is, all of which is to say, it might be a smart move, because, you know, maybe what he's feeling is that he needs to shore up his base. I think the biggest problem for Trump politically is that clearly what animated him and encouraged him both personally and politically were those rallies. You know, remember, he used to hold those rallies all through his presidency, very unusual for a president. I mean, you most of the time you should be governing. But for Trump, this was a core part of what kept him politically and psychologically alive. And perhaps these briefings play that role for him. So, I mean, as a matter of public policy, I dislike them a lot, because it means more of Trump's slightly bizarre interventions and off-the-cuff comments, which then have to become policy because he's president, right? That everyone has to pretend that these are serious policy proposals. But politically, he might be right. And he's more talented politically than we give him credit for.
Yeah. You mentioned the McCain thing. And since we're talking about baseball a little bit, there was a moment in 2015, it was that early, I think, when Trump went after John McCain that time as not really a hero. He's just seen as a hero because he was captured. And I knew an autograph dealer who happened to have Donald Trump's autograph on a baseball. And the autograph dealer, knowing what I do for a living, said, Trump, he's like rising in the polls right now in the Republican primaries, and I have this autographed Trump ball. When do you think will be the peak value? And I said, now. Oh, it's right now. You have to sell it right now. He said that thing about McCain. He's toast. Sell that ball. And he did. And he I don't know what he got for it, but he never came back and asked for me to make up the difference.
Well, in a sense, what you were saying was what most Republicans were saying. Remember, one of the things people forget is during that primary, other Republican primary candidates refused to attack Trump because they were so sure this was a kind of bizarre flash in the pan support that was going to collapse, and they wanted to benefit from the Trump voters, and so they didn't want to alienate them. And that was the rationale almost right up to the end that Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio would use as to why they weren't attacking him. And of course, when they finally started attacking him, it may have been too late, might have never worked in the first place. But so your analysis of Trump's peak value was exactly the same as Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and the 16 people who ran against him in the Republican primary.
I guess that should make me feel a little better. My analysis was the same as Ted Cruz. Your CNN special is called Donald Trump's Conspiracy Theories. Ted Cruz comes up in it. We'll talk about that. And, you know, my first impulse was to dismiss it when I saw the promos as kind of sensationalistic, like any other special on false conspiracy theories, Kennedy assassination conspiracy theories or whatever. But I did think, well, wait, this is Fareed Zakaria. He's a serious global affairs analyst. So explain to everybody who didn't see it last night, why do you find this a serious topic for a full hour special?
Thanks, Brian. You know, I begin the show, as you know, by saying, look, exactly the point you just made. This is not the kind of thing I normally do. I was reluctant to do it. But what became clear to me was that, first of all, not only are these conspiracy theories that are circulating widely now, they're not a fringe phenomenon. They're becoming a larger and larger part of the mainstream of American political culture. They are being encouraged by the President of the United States in many, many different ways, which we try to outline. It's a very clever, subtle form of encouragement that he gives, so that there's always some kind of plausible deniability, but he's clearly encouraging it. And most importantly, all of this now seems to be directed toward a single goal, which is to claim that there are various conspiracies afoot to try to deny Trump his rightful re-election, which means that he is setting up a conspiracy theory to say, if I lose, I was swindled out of this. And the theories are about mail-in ballots, the theories are about voter ID, about illegal immigrants voting, about ballots being mailed in by the Chinese Communist Party. And all of these are being quietly circulated so that you know, I think you have a critical mass. You've already laid the groundwork for something really devastating, which would be the refusal of a large part of the country. People are asking Trump whether he will accept the results of the election. That's not the relevant question. Has he sowed in the minds of many, many millions of Americans, tens of millions of Americans, the idea that the election is crooked? And if they don't accept it, what happens to an America where, let's say, 30% of the population says we don't accept this result and in some way or the other begins to protest against it?
How much do you think this is an impulse rising on both sides? I mean, not to draw any equivalency, and Trump uniquely peddles in conspiracy theories that he knows are false over and over again, the evidence indicates. But I was reminded in the eulogies for John Lewis over the last few days that Lewis led a group of Democratic members of Congress who boycotted Trump's inauguration because they said he was not a legitimate president because of Russian interference. So how much does this exist on both sides?
Yeah, I think it's a fair point. There are, in my view, excessive claims about, you know, whether it's Russian interference, Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, all of which there are kernels of truth to, but I think that have been exaggerated into a kind of massive, purposeful, coordinated theory that helped Trump. I think Mueller's report gets it about right, which is the picture is somewhat mixed on the issue of collusion. There's no question Trump tried to obstruct justice. That was Mueller's conclusion. I think it's very well researched. The big difference, Brian, is on one side, you have the President of the United States actively encouraging these theories. On the other side, you have a few politicians, in the case of John Lewis, a very distinguished one. But John Lewis is a congressman. He's not the president of the United States. And secondly, what you have in Trump is somebody who is actively trying to subvert the constitutional process and the peaceful transfer of power. John Lewis, as a mark of disrespect for Trump, did not attend the inauguration. He didn't tell people, you know, to come out on the streets and refuse to obey orders from Trump, you know. So it was more a kind of symbolic protest than anything else. Whereas my fear is, and it's not just a fear. Remember, we know the Pizzagate situation, right? The which we go into in the mm-hmm. on the show. This is a guy who hears all about this stuff that Hillary Clinton is running a child prostitution ring from a basement of a pizza parlor in Washington, and he goes to Washington with the arm to the teeth with AK-47s, all kinds of guns, bursts in, and finds, of course, that not only is there no child prostitution ring, the pizza parlor doesn't even have a basement. So there are people who are being motivated to action, which I think is very dangerous, by the president.
So theoretically, Trump could be trying to set up a constitutional crisis scenario where he is declared the loser of the electoral vote, and he actually refuses to leave office? Is that the ultimate fear here?
I think the most likely scenario I can imagine is there are five or six states in which, because of mail-in balloting, the contest, you know, it's close enough that they have to count every ballot. So first of all, you have no election result the night of the election, because there are five or six states in the balance. In those states, it's all about the mail-in ballots. And these guys start immediately putting pressure, saying these mail-in ballots are probably all fraud, they're illegal, we want to re-vote, we want to recount. And it's you know, so it could end up in the courts. It could end up in the House of Representatives, as it did in 1876. It could end up with the Supreme Court. And I just think it's a very sad outcome. I talk about on the show the fact that this has been one of America's greatest historical legacies for freedom and democracy. In 1800, when there's a transfer of power between Jefferson and Adams, it is the first time in modern history, it's really the first time in human history, that you had a peaceful transfer of power from one political party or one political group to another, without a contest, without violence, without anything. That's America's legacy to the world. And if we are going to, you know, what Trump is doing is he's playing with fire. This is a very dangerous situation, because one thing that it is true to your earlier question about the other side, if Trump makes this a huge issue, I mean, there are going to be Democrats who will do the same thing the next time around. Mm. And then are we going to have these elections decided every 4 years by a combination of the Supreme Court and whomever the army decides to side at that point? I mean, this is a scary scenario.
How much do you think any of these conspiracy theories could use racism as a foundation? We know Trump was the most famous proponent of birtherism, suggesting falsely that Obama was really a foreigner. And Trump seems to be running for re-election more based on defense of the Confederate flag than practically anything else at this point. Do you see his strategic racism playing into whatever conspiracy theory whom he might try to set up to be an election results denier, or are these separate issues?
Well, I think Trump is an equal opportunity conspiracy theorist, but just to say, I don't think he particularly cares whether it's a racist theory or not. And you're right, in the past, he's used ones like birtherism. I think where it ends up playing a very big role is there are clearly people in the Republican Party, particularly at the state level, who believe that it is important to suppress the vote, to use various kinds of restrictions on voting. Because it helps the Republican Party versus the Democratic Party. And so this is a very sad reality, because it is a shameful echo of the Jim Crow South, but it is clearly happening. When you see the places that polling stations are closed, they tend to be disproportionately in two places, in Black communities and in college communities, young people's communities. And those are, of course, the two places that are overwhelmingly voting liberal or Democratic these days. But I think there's one piece of this that's very encouraging, Brian. It's still not related to my special, mm-hmm. but it is that Trump's approval ratings have actually dropped significantly, not after COVID, but after the Black Lives Matter protests. And I think what happened there is, we're all speculating because these things happen at the same time. But the COVID period, he was doing okay. He had dropped a little. After the Black Lives Matter, he tried to play the white backlash card, the race card, you know, a very familiar one that politicians from Nixon and George Wallace have been doing for 30, 40 years. And I don't think it worked. I think America is in a different place today, because if you look at the decline in Trump support over the last 2 months, it is primarily among whites. It is primarily among white women. And I think that the country is saying, you know, we've had enough of this. So it may be that this kind of what it is really race baiting, this kind of race baiting isn't working as well, which is a very hopeful sign.
And I think one of the effects of Trump saying voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud with respect to mail-in ballots, even during a pandemic when you don't want a lot of people congregating at the polls, is to take the focus off the other side, which is a more clear and present danger to democracy in a sort of on the ground way, even though these are, issues of debate for voter ID and things like that. but it's taking our eye off the ball of voter suppression. Here's a clip from your special of a voter suppression expert, Professor Carol Anderson from Emory University.
Voter fraud, voter fraud. Here's the evidence. It's a lie. The beauty of a lie is if you say it over and over and with conviction, it sounds like the truth. Voter fraud doesn't change an election result. Voter suppression does.
Carol Anderson coming with her own band, her house band, for that clip. kidding, that was from the CNN intro, I guess, to your special, so it had the music behind it. But what do you think about that theory, that by Trump falsely saying voter fraud is going to be a huge problem? It takes the attention away from what they're really doing in terms of voter suppression.
Well, there's no question that it's correct, and it's not even a theory in the sense that when she says voter fraud doesn't change elections, voter suppression does. Here's the data. The studies analyzed, they looked for voter fraud. In a billion votes cast, that billion with a B, there were, I think, 36 cases of voter fraud. So it's about as likely that you will find voter fraud in the United States as that you will be struck by lightning. It just doesn't happen. It's a felony. You would be incredibly foolish to try it because it's not, you know, your one vote, your one act will not change the election, and there's a very serious penalty to it for it. Voter suppression, on the other hand, is very, you know, it's, as I say, it was part of the standard operating procedure of the Jim Crow South for a century. And in many ways, especially now that the Supreme Court essentially weakened the Voting Rights Act, it has returned, as I said, in these two particular places where you're trying to suppress black votes and you're trying to suppress the votes of young people. So I think it's not a theory. It's absolutely clear that voter suppression could have the effect of suppressing the votes of hundreds of thousands of people, whereas voter fraud, as I said, 36 out of 1 billion votes.
I want to take a call who raises the issue of Trump sending federal agents into Portland, Oregon, and now threatening to send them into New York and Chicago in relation to what we're talking about. Dan in Bayside, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dan.
Hi. One of the things that Mr. Zachariah and you and everybody seems to totally ignore is one of the tactics that Hitler used to slowly gain power. And that was his raising of a private army, you know, his stormtroopers. And initially they were just small out groupings, but they became more and more powerful. And Trump, and I've always wondered why Trump hadn't done that. And now I see he's doing exactly that.
Dan, I'm going to leave it there, and partly for the noise in the background. But Fareed, some people might think, well, that's an even more far-fetched scenario. Private armies, the federal agents are not that. And he seems to be losing the military, certainly the military leaders in certain respects. They're probably going to have a showdown over unnaming some of the military bases for Confederates, which the Pentagon supports removing those Confederate names. I think even Mitch McConnell in the Senate might support that in legislation now. But that's sort of Trump losing, at least starting to lose, the military leadership in a certain respect. But there are these armed militias, but they're small. But I don't know if we can look at the Homeland Security agents in that light. But what about what Dan raises?
So I think it's, you know, look, it's, there's a concern, but I have more faith in the federal troops, as you were suggesting, Brian. I don't think that federal troops in the United States are going to act as the private army of Donald Trump. I think that they're all law-abiding, constitutionally minded people, and the army in the United States is apolitical and will follow the Constitution and will not. Obey illegal orders, as far as I can tell. I think this is a miscalculation by Trump. So if you look at Portland, The situation was kind of crazy, and I think it was turning into a situation that I worried about politically, where local Democrats were essentially allowing a lot of disorder, a lot of graffiti and violence, and were not pushing back. And it, you know, there was always been this danger where the Democrats become identified as the party that is allowing kind of law and order to collapse. If Trump had stayed out, that would have been the story. Instead, the story is now Donald Trump and his extra constitutional or dubiously constitutional maneuver of forcing federal agents into the scene. So I don't think Trump is helping himself with this stuff. I think he's overreacting. I think it plays to the idea of a kind of unhinged narcissistic man who's kind of drunk from the well of power. We'll see. But I don't really worry that ultimately what we're asking is, do we believe the National Guard or the Army would obey illegal orders that serve Trump personally that were not constitutional? And I don't think that would happen.
Fareed Zakaria, he hosts Fareed Zakaria GPS Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern on CNN. He's a Washington Post columnist. And his special, Donald Trump's Conspiracy Theories, will re-air on CNN Friday night at 11 p.m. Eastern. Fareed, you can throw out the first pitch at my next softball game anytime.
You're very kind, Brian. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.